help clients whose fear of vulnerability keeps them stuck? Could a car salesman hold the key? Dr. Marsha Linehan is the creator of dialectical behavior therapy. And when Marsha works with stuck clients, especially those with shame, she likes to go in for the hard sell.
The other thing you have to do, what a lot of therapists don't do very well, I've noticed, is you have to sell the idea that new behaviors require. So you have to be like a salesperson. And in a sense, what therapists do is sell behavior. We're like a car salesman. They sell cars, we sell behavior. But you've got to have the same skills. I told my grad students I was going to bring a car salesman in to give us a talk. But I once read in a magazine all the things really good car salesmen do, and it sounded a swear, just like DVD. I'm not kidding. So you have to think of that. That is one of the things you're doing. So how do you do that? First of all, you have to know what the client's goals are. There's no point in trying to teach a skill or new behavior that ain't going to get them to their goals. So the first thing you have to do is really face the fact that your goals are not what's important, it's what the client's goals are. And then you have to know what they are, and then you've got to know what is needed to get there. I mean, that's the one thing I figure we're paid for. We're paid to know how to get from here to there. And our job then is to sell the client on the idea that's the way to do it. So you have to try to sell what is the pros and cons. You do pros and cons. What are the pros and the cons of not engaging this behavior? But to a certain extent, too, you have to know in effect the research. Like, if you do this, you'll get there. Okay? And it's very interesting in my skills book, where I have a lot of research. In the skills book, the second time I have loads of research, and the first time I didn't put hardly any research in. And I've been very surprised at how many clients have said to me, when I read the research on doing that, wow, it made a difference. I'm willing to do it now. So I think that many therapists don't spend enough time selling and talking to clients about why this behavior is going to be important. So you have to do that. So I'll give you an example. I have loads of examples of this. But so, for example, I had a client once I was treating, and she would come in to a session and then wouldn't talk. In fact, she would sort of hide in the chair. Okay, so you sit back like this, kind of like this. Okay. So I told her, I said, look, you've got to tell me why you're not telling me. Because anybody who's not talking at all has some reason for not talking. And I said, so my guess is you have a lot of shame. So she just sat there. So I said, look, shame is your mortal enemy. Because what shame does, shame makes you hide. Shame makes you hide. And when you hide, you not only are hiding from me, but you end up hiding from yourself. Because you don't want to know about all the things that you feel ashamed about. But when you start hiding from me and you hide from yourself, there's no way we can get you further. There's no way we can treat it. There's no way we can solve it. I can't help you while you're hiding. And you're not going to be able to help yourself because you're so ashamed that you're hiding from yourself also. So it is your mortal enemy. This is life and death. You've got to tell me why you're not telling me. At which point, the client finally told me, except she told me like this. Well, I was at my sister's house. Like that. So I said, look, that's still shame. You can't talk like that. You're going to have to talk loud. You're going to have to talk like you can tell it to me. So that took, I would say, 20, 30 minutes to finally get her into it. But finally she stood up and said, all right, I was at my sister's house, and told me the whole story. She says, is that good enough? I said, good. Now we can deal with it. So in many ways, you've got to drag out of them. But you have to drag it out by telling them that whatever that is life and death, they have got to do it. There's no way out. You cannot get them there. They don't. Do X, Y, Z, whatever it is. You know, I've treated a lot of clients with opiate, addiction. And I tell them, this is life and death. You take it again, you'll be addicted again. You get addicted again, you'll have to quit again. You have to quit again, you'll be miserable again. It's not worth it. Let's discuss the pros and cons. What's going to happen if you walk on that street where all your dealers are. And so pros and cons, you know, I've given a lot of thought to this because I started to realize if you started analyzing yourself, you would notice that all of us function like pros and cons. You know, I wake up in the morning and I'm really, really tired. So I don't want to get out of bed. So I think, okay, I have to be at work at such and such a time. I could stay in bed. Okay, I'll skip exercise because I'm too tired. But then my pros and cons are, I remind myself, I say, but the problem is if you don't exercise, you're more tired at work than if you do. Oh, right. Okay, I'll get up. So pros and cons, it turns out to be a really important skill in what we teach.
Marcia had an interesting take on selling clients on new behaviors. I wanted to get a fuller perspective on this, so I turned to Dr. Ron Siegel and Dr. Kelly McGonigal, Dr. Joan Borisenko, and Bill O'Hanlon.
You know, I talk about science help as a new kind of self-help, and that's definitely how I sell ideas. It's one way. I mean, another way is to actually ask people to directly test them in their own life. But the idea that you can sell ideas with science, science is pretty sexy to people. And so I just came across a study last week that I shared in a class I'm teaching now on behavior change for people who are trying to make a change in their lives. And this was a study that was done at Liverpool John Moores University in the UK. And this was a study that looked at whether focusing on your breath mindfully might increase your willpower, your self-control around tempting foods. And so in this study, they had some women do breath-focused meditation before they went through this kind of food torture test. And other women just went through the torture test. And I just thought, like, describing the torture test was so, I could see my students really coming alive at this. Because you can imagine this torture test. They took four different types of tempting foods and put them in Tupperware containers. And one at a time, they had the women peel the lid off and see what's inside of it. So in the first Tupperware container, it was Pringles. And then in another one, it was Rocky Road Cluster chocolate candy. And another one, it was Twix bars. And they had to pull out each one, and they had to look at it. And then they had to smell it. And they had to imagine eating it. And then they had to rub it across their lips and, like, lick their lips. And it was, like, the worst thing you could imagine for people who just want to eat these things, but they weren't allowed to eat them. And then afterwards, the psychologist brought in a big plate of cookies. And they just measured how many cookies these women ate. And the women who had practiced breath-focused mindfulness before they went through that torture test, they ate significantly fewer cookies than the women who hadn't. And that, to me, is an example of selling a practice or an idea with science, that it's possible that the next time, you know, a person in my class whose willpower challenge is weight or health, and they are looking at a plate of cookies or a carton of Pringles, and they're going to remember this study, and they're going to remember the tool we talked about, which is notice your breath. And they're going to feel less alone in it, too, because they're going to remember that there was this crazy study with other people who were tempted. So that I really encourage people to think in terms of selling ideas with concrete studies that help people really identify a choice point where they can apply a specific skill.
Having an evocative story goes a long way. Something else that is also often helpful, you know, I had a mentor of mine years ago said, you know, most people don't have very good maps for their mental experience. You know, stuff just happens, and there's very little scaffolding, you know, on which to hang it. Very, you know, it's like, oh, anxious, oh, depressed, oh, stuff is happening, but not a real understanding of how all these different experiences fit together. So I find that psychoeducational time, even though that also feels like not real therapy, you know, we're not necessarily delving into some painful emotion at the moment, but just to give people some kind of an idea for how things work, you know, like the idea that, oh, you know, every time I try to push a thought out of my mind, it tends to come back with a vengeance. Or, you know, if I push away that sad feeling, anxiety tends to pop up. And, you know, just these very basic mechanisms to give people an idea of what the structures are, how we're wired, so that then they could say, oh, well, so there's actually a reason for doing this, that, or the other thing.
When Marcelina said this, I thought, this is exactly the same as what I do when I coach people to write books. You have to have a clear problem.
Yeah.
You have to have a clear promise of where they're going to go. That's, you know, they have to have a future that they want to go towards, or they're not motivated. So they have to be motivated away from a problem, and you have to identify that clearly. If you don't start therapy on that clear basis, and you don't have a promise that you say, you know, like Marshall will say, I can get you there if you go through. And the third component is my program. That is, I have a set of steps that if we go through, it may be, you know, self-compassion, it may be mindfulness, it may be changing your cognitions, it may be changing your behavior, it may be doing couples therapy. I have some method to get you from where you've been that you're suffering from to where you long to be that you want to be, and I have a program to get you there. So there's really three components of marketing and selling, and there's three components of therapy. And I'd never made this connection before, Marcia Linehan, so that I thought, well, that's what I do when I coach people to write books. If they don't have a clear problem, a clear promise, and a clear program, that book is probably not going to be published by a publisher. They make it self-publish it. And that just brought me so much clarity that I'm thinking about my therapy like that all the time now. If there's a problem, maybe if it's not going well, maybe I haven't identified the problem well, or they haven't identified the problem well. Maybe we haven't made the right promise because they don't seem to be motivated. Or maybe my program, and Marshall Linehan said this, you've got to have a program that works. So it can't be just any program. So I've got to have a program that will get them from point A to point B. And that made things so simple and so clear. I really appreciated that analogy, which I never thought of. I don't like to think of myself as a salesperson in therapy, but it's a good analogy.
Well, I think this is important. People want a map. They want to know, where am I now? Where can I expect to go? And what road do I need to take to get there? And I think a lot of therapists make a mistake. They're really... they don't get what the goal necessarily is. People can come in, they're stuck, they've got a variety of things. You need to say, well, what's the major goal here? That's it. What are you here for? What are we working on? And how do we actually assess that you're getting a little bit better? That comes up too. You want to know. People are reinforced when change happens. And so it's good to build in some measurements of change and have some idea that, okay, how long is this going to take? How am I doing? What is it going to look like at the end? And that's context. And so, for example, a lot of people come in to therapy, as you know, we started to talk about 4 weeks ago now, with a big problem. The bottom has just fallen out. Others, well, it's not so clear. They're kind of stuck. They're in that cocoon stage. But when things fall apart for people, I use a particular context that's very, very useful to them. And that is a map. The context, you're having a rite of passage. Everything falls apart and life is not what it was before. And then you enter this in-between space between no longer and not yet, liminal space, where all kinds of stuff happens, mentoring happens, old beliefs come up, you get to change. And then the third stage is return. You have some sort of transformation. And people just calm down when they realize, oh, I'm not stuck forever, I'm just in liminal space. And there's a program. How do you get through liminal space? First, you have to grieve. Then you have to clarify your values. Then you need to find mentors. Then eventually you'll reach a stage where not only are you transformed, but you can bring that to your family, to your community, and to others. That instantly calms people down. Because what you're telling them is, yeah, you're in the unknown, but the unknown is a known place, and people do get through it. And I think it's one of the most important things in therapy is creating a sense of safety and an expectation of hope and results, and that you do have to be a good salesman to say, here's the package. Here's what the community looks like. Here's the model house. Here's, you know, this one hasn't been built yet, but here are the plans, and get people to really buy into that. That's a big part of the intervention itself.
Pros and cons can be a very helpful way of motivating a client who's avoiding the idea of change. In the next video, we'll learn how to foster positive growth by leaning into discomfort.